Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 1.15, Bulgarian Horrors, Bulgarian Liberation, Part 4. Last time, we saw the Bulgarian revolutionaries go for broke as they launched the April Uprising in the spring of 1876. But their gamble ultimately ended in disaster, mainly due to the fact that the uprising had been launched prematurely and therefore haphazardly, as well as due to the presence of tens of thousands of Ottoman irregular soldiers known as the Bashi Bazouk, who ruthlessly put down the rebellion. But even though the April Uprising was a complete strategic failure in the short term, Bulgaria would be liberated by the spring of 1878, just 2 years after the Bulgarian Revolutionary Central Committee had launched their revolt. So, how did this happen? Well, as we will discuss today, the fate of the Bulgarian people and their Balkan neighbors will ultimately lay in the hands of, surprise, surprise, the great powers. Because, as had happened during the Greek Revolution, European public opinion is about to quickly turn against the Ottomans, as details of the atrocities committed by the Bashi Bazouk against Bulgarian civilians will make front-page news all across Europe, and even over in the US. And critically, the public outcry in support of the Bulgarians will be loudest in Great Britain and Russia. But before we take stock of the international scene, let's first try and understand what exactly happened in the aftermath of the April Uprising. And for this, we will begin by asking, who are the Bashi Bazouk? So, for some context. Throughout the 1860s and 1870s, there were a few broad demographic shifts occurring within the Ottoman Empire, and these shifts would significantly impact Bulgaria. We have briefly touched upon this in previous episodes, but during and after the Crimean War, the defeated Russians launched a violent campaign against Muslim populations living in the borderlands of southern Russia. Essentially, the Russians initiated a project of settler colonialism in the regions around the Black Sea, and as part of this colonial project, Russian authorities would encourage Christian populations to settle in this Black Sea region, mainly Orthodox Russians, but also Orthodox Greeks, Bulgarians, and Serbs from the Balkans. Well, as these Christian populations were encouraged to move into the region around the Black Sea in southern Russia, there were, of course, people already living there. But many of these people were Muslim, and so they did not fit within Russia's grand imperial project of building a greater Orthodox empire. So, these Muslim populations that were primarily made up of ethnic Circassians and ethnic Tatars would be rounded up by the Russian Imperial Army, and then they would either be violently driven from their homes or just massacred en masse. During this process, literally millions of Tatars were driven out of the Crimea, and then upwards of 95% of the Circassian population was completely wiped out, so that the Caucasus region around the Black Sea was almost entirely cleansed of the Muslims who had for centuries lived in the region. So yeah, this was a humanitarian catastrophe, and the Circassian genocide specifically was the deadliest ethnic cleansing of the entire 19th century, resulting in upwards of 1.5 million deaths. So as we move forward, it is important to keep this context in mind, because many Russian leaders are about to decry the brutality of the Ottomans against their Christian populations as the Russians attempt to use Ottoman mismanagement as a pretext for exerting Russian influence in the Balkans. And while I do want to stress the fact that Ottoman violence against Christians was very real and very brutal, and while Balkan Christians often had no choice but to look towards their great Orthodox father in Russia for help, just remember that the Russians were potentially even more brutal in their own genocidal campaigns against Muslims. Because more than anything else, what we're seeing here is ethnic minorities falling victim to large imperialist projects within both Ottoman and Russian domains. As so often happens with these large-scale projects meant to create homogeneous populations, everyday people usually kind of get screwed. And in the context of these Russian genocidal campaigns, the way that everyday people were getting screwed was quite widespread and quite complex. Because Where did all these Circassians and Tatars go? You know, at least the ones who were lucky enough to avoid being massacred. Well, they went to the Ottoman Empire, as the Ottomans decided to accept these fellow Muslims as refugees. And while this was a noble gesture, the Ottomans brought their characteristic mismanagement to this refugee crisis, and the resettlement of the Circassians and Tatars was incredibly chaotic and disruptive, especially within Christian-majority regions. In Bulgaria specifically, many of these Muslim refugees were actually conscripted into the imperial army upon their arrival. And so these refugees, who I'm sure were just thrilled about being immediately forced into the Ottoman military after undergoing a harrowing journey surviving genocide, were given weapons. And then many Bulgarian Christians were literally forced out of their homes in order to make room for these recently armed refugees. Well, as you might expect, this created quite a lot of tension, and sporadic violence would from this point on continuously pop up between the Christian and Muslim populations of Bulgaria. So, the influx of Muslim refugees escaping arbitrary violence at the hands of the Russian imperial government inserted a certain level of ethno-religious tension that had previously been somewhat absent, or at least if it was present, it had been of a different character. Now, I don't want to overplay this. Christian Bulgarians had been forced to live as second-class citizens under the Ottoman regime for centuries. But as we've noted before, the different ethno-religious groups were historically separated into confessional communities known as millets. And the millets were, for the most part, allowed to govern their own affairs, and people of different millets would kind of leave each other alone. Plus, as we've discussed, Bulgaria was a province that had been the focus for Tanzimat reformers like Midhat Pasha, who tried to bring about some level of equality between the millets, offering official positions to Christians and reforming the judicial system. Well, the traumatic violence experienced by Muslim refugees at the hands of the fanatical Russian Orthodox armies would sharpen tensions between Christians and Muslims in a new and terrible way. And a handful of these Muslim refugees would seek to take their revenge on Orthodox Bulgarians. This tension between Muslims and Christians would bubble under the surface for years, and following their expulsion from Russia, a number of Circassian and Tatar Muslims would be recruited into the ranks of the Bashibazouk. And these Circassians and Tatars were joined by Muslim Albanians as well as Muslim Bulgarians. Now, we haven't talked about this yet, but there was, and still is, a pretty significant number of Muslims living in Bulgaria, who are neither Circassian, nor Tatar, nor Albanian, but are ethnically Bulgarian. These Bulgarians had, like many, many people in the Ottoman Empire, converted to Islam some point in the remote Ottoman past. Now, a commonly told story, especially amongst Bulgarian nationalist historians, is that these Bulgarians were forced to convert to Islam. And while this probably did happen to some people, it seems much more likely that most of these Bulgarians correctly saw conversion to Islam as a way to advance in Ottoman society. But regardless of the reasons for conversion, there had grown a sizable population of ethnic Bulgarian Muslims who would become known as Pomaks. So, a handful of these Pomaks would also join the Bashibazouk alongside their fellow Muslims, be them Circassian, Tatar, or Albanian. And as we said at the end of last episode, tens of thousands of these Bashibazouk had been organized inside of Bulgaria when the April Uprising was launched by the Bulgarian Revolutionary Central Committee in 1876. And this was a big reason why the April Uprising was ultimately a failure, because these Bashibazouk, who were originally going to be deployed against the Serbian rebels over in Bosnia-Herzegovina, were easily redirected and used to quell the unrest in Bulgaria. As we also noted, the Bashibazouk were a unique military force in that they were not paid by the Ottoman Imperial Government, which was a pretty good arrangement because said Ottoman government was at this point completely broke. Instead of being paid as regular soldiers, the Bashibazouk were compensated primarily through plunder. So during their campaigns, they were given free rein to really do whatever they wanted, and because of this, they became infamous for their reckless brutality, with robbery, pillage, massacre, torture, and sexual violence being a built-in part of their normal operations. So when the Bashibazouk were unleashed on the Bulgarian population in order to quell the unrest set off by the April uprising, they just kind of did what they always did, and widespread atrocities were committed against armed rebels and against unarmed civilians. The most dramatic and spectacular example of these atrocities occurred in the Bulgarian town of Batak. As part of the preparation for the April uprising, Batak had been designated by the Assembly of the Apostles as part of the 4th Revolutionary District centered in Plovdiv, and the inhabitants of Batak were assigned the task of raiding Ottoman storehouses in their surrounding area in order to arm and provision Bulgarian rebels. Well, you may remember that the 4th Revolutionary District of Plovdiv was where the uprising had been prematurely launched 2 weeks early after the Bulgarian revolutionaries living in the district had been betrayed to the authorities. In the weeks leading up to the revolt, the Bulgarians of Batak succeeded in taking supplies from Ottoman storehouses, but they were quickly reported to the authorities. Then, in the chaos that followed the premature revolt of late April, 5,000 Bashibazouk were sent to quell the revolutionaries holding out in Batak. These Bashibazouk vastly outnumbered the Batak rebels, so after a quick initial battle, the Bulgarians decided to surrender their weapons because they correctly realized that they were heavily outnumbered and completely surrounded. The leader of the Bashibazouk initially accepted the surrender and disarmed the Batak rebels. But instead of moving along, the Bashibazouk proceeded to sack the town, and during this sack, widespread atrocities were committed, not only against the rebels who had taken up arms, but also against the town's civilian population, who were now helplessly trapped in Batak. This included women and children. And what follows is really a nightmarish sequence with absolutely absurd and horrific scenes of indiscriminate violence. And please feel free to skip 15 seconds ahead if you don't want to be triggered here. But firsthand accounts of the Batak massacre report absolutely brutal acts like people being impaled and then roasted alive, and corpses getting dismembered, and large groups of people being locked in churches and burned alive, and even children and babies being killed. I mean, it's absolutely horrific, and a lot of these firsthand accounts are really, really hard to read. And I don't want to unnecessarily disturb you by poring over too many of these details. And I think it's enough to know that horrific crimes against humanity were committed by the Bashibazouk at Batak. And in the end, it is estimated that close to 5,000 of the 7,000 inhabitants of the town were killed during this massacre. And the Batak massacre was simply the most dramatic example of the widespread atrocities committed by the Bashibazouk against the Bulgarians, as an estimated 15,000 Bulgarians were killed in the nearby city of Plovdiv, bringing the total number killed to somewhere just south of 30,000. And the numbers are only a small part of the story, as the specific manner in which people were killed was in many ways what sympathetic Europeans found most horrifying in these firsthand accounts. And now, we do need to discuss in some detail the nature of these firsthand accounts, because their origin does matter. And while I work through some of this, please keep in mind that the Batak massacre was immediately the source of widespread controversy, and the event is still highly contentious to this day. So, let's unpack all of this because it is super important. News of the Batak massacre first began to filter to Western sources through students at Robert College, a school in Constantinople that had recently been founded by an American philanthropist. After Bulgarian students of the school brought the atrocities to the attention of the school's faculty, teachers began writing to British and American ambassadors and newspaper editors alerting them to the massacre. This prompted the British and American embassies to send representatives and British and American newspapers to send investigative journalists into Bulgaria to report on what had been going on. So, most of the firsthand accounts of the Batak massacre come from these American and British journalists and diplomats who were sent to investigate the atrocities. The fact that these accounts came from Western sources is important for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, as stories of the Batak massacre filtered back to places like the US, France, and especially Great Britain, it created an absolute sensation that can only really be compared to the outpouring of support for the Greeks in the 1820s during the Greek Revolution. Basically, the Batak massacre was on the front page of every single newspaper in the Western world, and the events of Batak would be covered in over 3,000 different newspaper articles. And in England specifically, the Bulgarian question instantly became a highly charged political issue for much of the same reasons that the Greek cause had 50 years earlier. As had been the case during the Greek Revolution, the official position of the British government was still to support the Ottoman Empire and its territorial integrity. And this was because of all the things we've talked about surrounding the Eastern question and the Great Game. See episode 1.11. It had long been a British priority to check Russian imperial ambitions and to prevent them from snatching territory away from the Ottomans. Well, as news of the atrocities committed against the Bulgarians filtered back home to England, it became increasingly awkward, yet again, for British leaders to stand idly by while fellow Christians were being massacred by the Ottomans. And then, the man who would really heighten the Bulgarian cause as a political issue was William Gladstone, the hugely influential leader of the Liberal Party in Great Britain. So let's talk about William Gladstone. The real pinnacle of what is sometimes called Gladstonian liberalism came about during the 1860s and early 1870s, culminating with Gladstone's tenure as Prime Minister from 1868 to 1874. But by the time the Bulgarian uprisings rolled around in 1876, William Gladstone had lost his seat to the conservative Benjamin Disraeli, and it kind of seemed like old William might just ease into a nice retirement, having now served in public office for over 40 years. But the now nearly 70-year-old Gladstone wasn't done yet, and he decided to use the Bulgarian issue as a platform by which to stage his comeback. And he would really go all in with this, eventually even traveling to Batak to personally pay homage to the Bulgarian victims. And Gladstone would go on to publish multiple pamphlets on the Bulgarian atrocities, including the now somewhat famous pamphlet entitled Bulgarian Horrors and the Question of the East. In this pamphlet, Gladstone launched broadsides against his political rival, Benjamin Disraeli, for his official support of the Ottoman government, and he called on Great Britain to intervene on behalf of the Bulgarians and other Slavs living under Ottoman oppression. Gladstone's pamphlet helped to initiate a wave of anti-Ottoman sentiment, with major European public figures joining Gladstone in his calls for European intervention, such as scientists Charles Darwin and Herbert Spencer, authors Victor Hugo and Oscar Wilde, and the Italian revolutionary Giuseppe Garibaldi. Now, Gladstone's pamphlet, Bulgarian Horrors, honestly perfectly encapsulates why the Bulgarian atrocities have been so contentious from the day they happened. Because when you really read Gladstone's pamphlet, it is, for lack of a better way to put it, just super racist. The thing is chock full of demagogic and racialized language with passages describing Turks as, quote, the one great anti-human specimen of humanity. And then the whole thing was also wrapped up in anti-Semitism as Gladstone railed against a supposed secret Jewish influence driving events behind the scenes when it came to the Eastern question. And these anti-Semitic attacks were no doubt connected to the fact that Gladstone's political rival, Benjamin Disraeli, against whom he was launching his attacks, was ethnically Jewish. So what this ultimately comes down to is that Gladstone's support of the Bulgarians was very much wrapped up in the prejudiced attitudes of late 19th century British exceptionalism, which viewed British Christians as racially superior to everyone else on earth. Even the Bulgarians, who people like Gladstone were defending, were often the subject of degrading stereotypes in the reporting as they were either portrayed as helpless and weak victims, or just as often as lazy and drunk, quote, orientalized Christians. And then the real kicker here, and the big reason why this issue is still so controversial, is the anti-Islamic language in much of the reporting. One of the most influential firsthand accounts came from the American journalist Janarius McGatton, who had traveled to Batak in the summer of 1876. McGatton's reporting was very important in bringing the plight of the Bulgarians to the attention of the wider world. And in his reporting, he leaned heavily into some pretty absurd Islamic stereotyping. For example, when explaining why the atrocities were committed, he said, quote, The reason is simple. When a Mohammedan has killed a certain number of infidels, he is sure of paradise, no matter what his sins may be. And then Gladstone would also make use of such stereotypes in his own pamphlets when he similarly answered the question of why the atrocities took place, explaining that Muslims, quote, "For the guide of this life, they had a relentless fatalism. For its reward hereafter, a sensual paradise." So yeah, I mean, we don't have to go that much further into it. These are pretty ridiculous statements that are very intentionally deploying an orientalized vision of Islam. And these sorts of degrading stereotypes have had an impact on the way Western Christians and secularists view Islam then and now. So what we can say is that these accounts were very important in bringing the very real sufferings of the Bulgarians to the attention of the wider world. And the fact that the Bulgarian cause became the center of public controversy in Western countries would become super important for the cause of Bulgarian liberation. All of this is true, and all of this is very important. But we also just have to kind of live with the fact that these reports leaned heavily into racialized stereotypes of non-Western peoples. And, as had also been the case with many Philhellenes who supported the Greek Revolution, a huge part of the public outrage specifically centered around the fact that white European Christians were being massacred by orientalized Muslims. Within the historical context of the time, the reporting on the Bulgarian atrocities was a public relations nightmare for the Ottomans. Over the past 30 years, the Ottomans had implemented many reforms as part of the Tanzimat program, specifically to improve their image amongst Western Europeans. Now they were seeing all of this hard work go out the window, basically overnight, because Western public opinion is going to pivot hard against the Ottomans as a result of the Bulgarian horrors. And this will leave the Ottomans isolated and vulnerable. Remember, over the past several decades, the Ottomans had been saved on multiple occasions by British, French, and even Russian intervention. And in recent years, the Ottomans had relied heavily on the British to prevent Russian incursion. And as Gladstone and other prominent intellectuals turned public opinion in Great Britain against the Ottomans, the Russians were beginning to sense that the opportunity they had long been waiting for, really ever since their loss in the Crimean War, was finally here, and they might now have the diplomatic space needed to launch their war against the Ottomans. And it should be no surprise at all to learn that in Russia, anti-Ottoman sentiment was most pronounced and most widespread. In places like Great Britain and France, the debate surrounding the Bulgarian question was over whether or not to continue supporting the Ottoman Empire, and there were still a lot of people out there advocating for a continued Ottoman presence in the Balkans. In Russia, though, the public debate was not over whether or not to intervene, but instead, the debate was over what manner and for what exact purpose an intervention should be launched. To way oversimplify things here, there had in recent years emerged a split within Russian imperial politics between the Westernizers, who wanted to reform the Russian Empire by, well, Westernizing, and then the Slavophiles, who wanted to maintain Russia's unique identity as the most powerful Slavic nation. We talked briefly about Pan-Slavism in the last episode when we introduced the Russian ambassador in Constantinople, Count Ignatieff. Well, Count Ignatieff was part of a much larger Pan-Slavic movement that had really begun to gain some momentum in the mid-19th century. And these Slavophiles, as they were called, took it for granted that Russia, the most powerful Slavic political entity, would be the natural leader of the Slavic peoples. This was akin to German nationalists looking towards Prussia and Italian nationalists looking towards Piedmont-Sardinia as ethnic leaders due to the fact that these countries had the military might necessary to carve out a large nation based upon a shared ethnic heritage. Slavophiles like Count Ignatieff had long supported nationalist movements in the Balkans, so naturally, the Bulgarian horrors became a real rallying cry for the Pan-Slavs, because Bulgarians were, you know, Slavic. So, as had happened in Western Europe, many prominent Russians who held Pan-Slavic beliefs came out in support of the Bulgarians, including author Fyodor Dostoevsky, who felt that Russia should actually go off and conquer Constantinople, with the eventual goal of forging a vast Slavic empire centered in the old Orthodox capital of the Byzantine Empire. And this was not at all a fringe position, as it was pretty common in Russia and in other Slavic countries to refer to Constantinople as Tsargrad, in order to imply that the Russian conquest of Constantinople and the reestablishment of Orthodoxy in Byzantine lands were inevitabilities. So with the conquest of Constantinople as an eventual goal, clearly Slavophiles like Count Ignatieff and Dostoevsky were gonna push for an intervention to support the Bulgarian Slavs. In opposition to the Slavophiles were the Westernizers. But like I said, the Westernizers weren't against intervention in the Balkans. They just disagreed on the specific goals of said intervention. The Slavophiles wanted to liberate Balkan countries in order to create a giant Slavic superstate that would include Balkan Slavs, such as Bulgarians and Serbs, and this Slavic superstate was to be led by the Russians. The Westernizers, on the other hand, wanted to liberate Balkan countries kind of for the sake of liberating them, and they saw Russia less as the overlord of Orthodox Slavdom, and more as a benevolent liberator, helping to drive the tyrannical Turks out of Europe. But at the same time, even for the Westernizers, it was seen as just good foreign policy to assert influence over the Balkan Slavs because Russian hegemony in the Balkans would ensure Russian domination of the Turkish Straits. Okay, so as we can see, the Bulgarian atrocities received widespread attention across Europe. But what does this all really mean? Well, it means that the historic allies of the Ottomans, the British and the French, are beginning to seriously cool on the Ottomans. Then, the historic nemesis of the Ottomans, the Russians, are experiencing a wave of intense anti-Ottoman patriotic war fever. And well, you can probably see where all of this is headed. But it is still going to take a very specific sequence of events for war to finally break out between the Russians and the Ottomans. And this is because the international diplomatic scene had in recent years undergone a dramatic transformation. And this transformation was called Otto von Bismarck. Now, the great Iron Chancellor will figure heavily in our next couple of episodes, as he is going to host the treaty negotiations that will ultimately resolve the crisis set off by the Bulgarian revolts. But for the quick rundown, within the context of increasing popularity of pan-German nationalism amongst liberals, Bismarck, a conservative, made the unification of Germany a reality. However, this was done not through liberal constitutionalism, which had been the dream of German nationalists during the revolutions of 1848, but rather Bismarck used the military might of Prussia to bring the German states together, his famous formulation of blood and iron. Bismarck would deploy his now iconic diplomatic strategy of Realpolitik to initiate a series of wars throughout the 1860s and 1870s, and these wars would culminate in Prussian victories over the Austrians in 1866 and then over the French in 1871. To put it rather simply, Prussia's defeat of the Austrians led Prussia to emerge as the dominant Germanic power, eclipsing Austria. And after the war, Bismarck would forge the North German Confederation, which specifically excluded Austria. This was notable because Austria had long been considered the foremost Germanic power. After this defeat, Austria's loss of influence would force them to join up with the Hungarians in the dual monarchy of Austria-Hungary. Then, 4 years later, Bismarck would once again use his diplomatic genius to precipitate a war with the Second French Empire, and this war would see the German army marching all the way to Paris. This led to a long, grueling siege of Paris that ultimately would result in the overthrow of the Second French Empire and the establishment of the Third French Republic. And amidst this chaos, radical Parisians would famously attempt to establish the Paris Commune. And the Paris Commune is a super interesting and super influential political experiment that would inspire many radical thinkers like Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, and Mao. So we'll be talking a whole lot more about the legacy of the Paris Commune as we move through future revolutions. But if you want to go ahead and learn more about the Paris Commune, check out Mike Duncan's 8th season of Revolutions. It covers the events of the Paris Commune in 8 succinct episodes, and it's fabulous. along with the establishment of the Third French Republic. The Franco-Prussian War also led to the declaration of the German Empire, as Bismarck essentially used the war to show the German states the benefits of joining together into a single union. But of course, this new German Empire was established under Prussian domination. And with the establishment of the German Empire, the European balance of power would significantly shift as Germany would emerge as really the preeminent power in Central Europe. Now, to get back to the crisis surrounding the Bulgarian atrocities. Moving into the 1870s, in the wake of the Franco-Prussian War, Chancellor Bismarck had emerged as the force to be reckoned with diplomatically. And in 1873, just as our old friend Vasil Levski was getting executed down in Bulgaria, Bismarck was putting together the so-called League of the Three Emperors, which was an agreement between the German, Russian, and Austro-Hungarian empires. And this was a self-conscious revamp of the old post-Napoleonic Holy Alliance, except just replace the Austrian Chancellor Metternich with the German Chancellor Bismarck. And like the old Holy Alliance, the League of the Three Emperors was similarly committed to maintaining the status quo of Europe. And this meant an inherent aversion to war, and as a result, an inherent aversion to revolutions. So, yet again, we're seeing phantoms of the Greek Revolution rise as the international scene looks eerily familiar to the lead-up to the Allied intervention at the Battle of Navarino, which brought the Greek War of Independence to an abrupt and sudden close. As had been the case during the Greek Revolution, the Russian Tsar, who is now Alexander I, by the way, found himself officially committed to the status quo, while he was also facing increasing internal pressure to declare war on the Ottomans in defense of fellow Orthodox Slavs in Bulgaria and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Bismarck had originally put together the League of the Three Emperors because he understood that the biggest threat to the newly formed German Empire would come if France were able to forge an alliance with either Austria-Hungary or Russia. So, Bismarck tried to get ahead of this by making his own alliances with these two neighboring empires. But in order to put together such an alliance, Bismarck had to arrange a mutually beneficial settlement, and a huge part of the negotiations surrounded who would have hegemony over the Balkans, Russia or Austria-Hungary. In the wake of Austria's defeat at the hands of the Prussians, the Balkans became ever more important to the Austrians because they had not only lost territory and influence in the German states to the north, but they had also lost territory and influence to the newly unified Kingdom of Italy, whose War of Independence had been fought against the Austrians and had been wrapped up in the broader war with Prussia. So the Austrians at this point were on a major decline, and because they had lost so much territory and influence in Central and Southern Europe, this meant that their territory in Eastern Europe was more important than ever. And in Eastern Europe, the Austrians had long ruled over a large Slavic population in the territories bordering Serbia, Romania, and Bosnia. So Austria was very sensitive to the issue of Pan-Slavism. Unlike Russia, Austria-Hungary did not, I repeat, did not support Slavic nationalism, because they did not want their own Slavic subjects living in the Austro-Hungarian Empire to, you know, get any ideas. And they were also afraid of the creation of a large Slavic state right on their doorstep, whether this be an expanded Russian Empire or an enlarged and aggressive new Slavic nation such as Serbia or Bulgaria. Bismarck was attuned to this tension between Russia and Austria. So a part of the agreement within the Three Emperors League was to divide influence and hegemony over the Balkans between Austria-Hungary and Russia, with the Austrians being designated the Western Balkans in places like Bosnia-Herzegovina, and the Russians being granted influence over the Eastern Balkans in Romania and Bulgaria, with Serbia, as we'll see, kind of vacillating between the two powers. This arrangement was enough to temporarily satisfy both sides. So, Germany, Russia, and Austria-Hungary had entered into this alliance in 1873 with a shared commitment to upholding the status quo and to combating revolutionary activity. But the League of the Three Emperors had been built upon an extremely shaky foundation, and the competing interests of Austria-Hungary and the Russians in the Balkans specifically would ultimately unravel this agreement. And this unraveling would accelerate once news of the Bulgarian atrocities began to spread across Europe. Because as the public outcry in Russia against Ottoman misrule became ever louder, Tsar Alexander was finding it increasingly difficult to stand idly by while fellow Orthodox Slavs were being massacred. So, in response to the crisis in the Balkans, the Tsar began making informal arrangements in the summer of 1876, just a couple months after the April Uprising, and it was becoming ever more apparent that these arrangements were in preparation for an inevitable conflict with the Ottomans. So, in July of 1876, Tsar Alexander would arrange a meeting with the Austro-Hungarian Emperor, Franz Joseph, and the purpose of this meeting was to discuss what the official policy of the Three Emperors League should be concerning the ongoing crisis down in the Balkans. Much of this agreement, called the Reichstag Agreement, was kept intentionally obscure. But it is clear that the two emperors agreed on a future policy for the Balkans, and this informal agreement would have major consequences for the future of both the Ottoman Empire and the Balkan nation-states currently fighting for their independence. In short, Russia agreed to allow Austria-Hungary to annex Bosnia-Herzegovina in exchange for Russia being allowed to annex more territory on either side of the Black Sea, specifically Bessarabia, which was then part of Romania, as well as Ottoman territory in the Caucasus. And then the real biggie for our friends down in Bulgaria was that the two emperors made a vague commitment to ensuring that the Balkan Christians would be granted a certain level of independence. But, as we have just said, Russia and Austria-Hungary had very different goals when it came to revolutionary movements in the Balkans. Remember, the Russians were increasingly being led by Slavophiles who wanted to create a large Slavic state that would be dominated by Russia, while the Austrians were super-duper against such a Slavic state because, first and foremost, they wanted to check Russian expansion, but they were also becoming increasingly worried about a powerful and large Slavic nation being formed that could challenge Austrian sovereignty over their territory in the northern Balkans that was chock full of Slavs. So, as a compromise, the Russian Tsar agreed that they would not support the creation of a large Slavic state in the Balkans in the aftermath of a war with the Ottomans. And this is going to become hugely important once this war between the Russians and Ottomans does eventually break out. Because, as we will see, the Russians will ultimately liberate Bulgaria, and they will promise the Bulgarians a huge amount of territory in the treaty negotiations following this war of liberation. But the creation of this so-called Big Bulgaria in the Treaty of San Stefano will not only anger the Austro-Hungarians, but the British as well. And so, once again, we will have a good old international crisis on our hands surrounding the collapsing Ottoman Empire, and how this collapse will affect the competing imperial interests of the Russians, the British, and increasingly, the Austro-Hungarians. So, next week's episode is going to be a real doozy full of absolute insanity for the Ottomans, with widespread uprisings, diplomatic isolation, a financial crisis, war with Serbia, debt defaults, multiple coups, and even the promulgation of a brand new constitution. And ultimately, all of this insanity will lead the Ottomans to lose nearly all of their European territory, which will create future instability in the Balkans that will set Europe on a dangerous course headed straight towards World War I. So, join me next week as we begin to unpack the Great Eastern Crisis.